how do revolutions get created, and how are political scientists interpreting the protests and demonstrations we're seeing right now?
We're not looking at what I would call revolt. We're looking at fairly conventional-looking protest demonstrations and rallies, but they are large. They are global.
That's Springfield political scientist Richard Gilman Opalski. We'll talk to him about what revolution means and its history, the topic of his new book, Spectres of Revolt. Also, all it together and it's like a push a nation on the rise. Yeah, man. Children's reggae musician Aaron Nigel Smith is in Central Illinois for a concert this weekend. He joins us to perform in studio and talk about how he makes music for the whole family. That's all coming up on this Friday edition of the 21st, but first, the latest news. Not too many dollars and not too many smiles if it's just welcome to the 21st, this Friday, February 3rd. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Revolt doesn't always look like 1968, the Arab Spring, or maybe even uprisings and protests in Baltimore and Ferguson. So writes Springfield-based political scientist Richard Gilman Opalski. He's chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. His new book is called Spectres of Revolt, and he's on the line with us now from Springfield. Richard, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
My pleasure, Nyla. Good to be here.
Richard, you write about how every moment in between revolt is actually a time before a revolt. And I was thinking about this when I was reading this because I was wondering what you thought of when you saw all of the protests and marches that happened recently during Inauguration Weekend.
Well, I think the protests and marches, the big rallies, not just in the U.S., but all around the world, are possibly an indication of revolt on the horizon, revolt in the future. At this point, we're not looking at what I would call revolt. We're looking at fairly conventional-looking protest demonstrations and rallies, but they are large. They are global. And I think that using the language of my book, the Trump administration is going to be haunted by a number of things. It's going to be haunted by many of the things that Trump himself has said that have been recorded and come back to haunt him. It will be haunted by the fact that his popular vote loss was so severe when we look at American political history. And it will be haunted by the specter of revolt. It will be haunted by the possibility that these protest demonstrations and rallies might become something else.
Before we go further, because I do want to talk about this specter of revolt and the haunting that you get into in your book, can you define revolt and revolution? How do you understand these terms and how should we be thinking about it?
Yeah, that's a really good and important question. Revolt is different than revolution because it is not a revolution in the classical sense of a overthrow of the existing state of affairs, a takeover of the institutions of governance, and then setting them down on the new course with new personnel. Revolts typically don't do that. So revolts don't accomplish what the old philosophers from Karl Marx over 160 years ago onto the present imagined that a revolution would be. A revolt is kind of like an expression of a revolutionary desire within the society, but it is not itself a revolution. It's also different, a revolt. It's also different from social movements, rallies, and protest demonstrations. One of the distinguishing factors or features, one of the distinguishing features of a revolt is that it runs up against the law or transgresses the law, or breaks the law directly.
And you also talk about, as we're thinking about this, I think it might be helpful to define another term that you write about, which is culture jamming. And I think that kind of gets into the notion of the way people are protesting now. Can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, the idea of the culture jam, or of culture jamming, really has a somewhat recent popularity on the left as an activist tactic, as the tact as a tactic that activists use when they are trying to think about how to say something very critical about the world without having the usual resources, without having a radio show that airs every week, without having a popular newspaper or television show. How can they intervene in the cultural landscape and say something about the world? And so culture jammers have adopted forms of activism where they repurpose materials in the society, in the cultural landscape. For example, like the Billboard Liberation Front was a small band of people who climbed up onto billboards and made them say not what the people who bought the billboard space wanted them to say, but rather what the activists thought that they should say. But in my book, I'm trying to think about culture jamming less as something that a small group of celebrity activists carry out, and more as something that we might all participate in so that we can change the conversation, so that we can get people to thinking against the dominant discussions in the society.
And so you write, yeah, you write about, like, for example, you write about the Occupy movement. Like, how would you, where would the Occupy Wall Street movement fit into this?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you. Well, Occupy Wall Street was not a conventional culture jam of the kind I just mentioned. Occupy Wall Street is more like the type of culture jamming I think we need. It's a culture jam in the sense that when Occupy Wall Street broke out, it was only on Wall Street for a short time before it ended up being in many cities without Wall Streets and around the world. What it did was it changed the conversation. So in the recent election cycle, we heard Bernie Sanders, and for that reason also I think Hillary Clinton, take up the question of income inequality. And the 1%, the famous, now famous image of the wealthy 1%. And that actually came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement. It came out of the streets. It didn't come first out of the mouths of a senator. It came out of occupied parks. And that's a culture jam because really with Occupy Wall Street, for the first time since the late 1960s, people in the United States were talking about capitalism. They were talking about severe income inequality, about class, about the opposition of the wealthiest 1% against the rest of us. And what a good culture jam does is it intervenes in the conversation and it changes its course radically in a different direction. And so I want us to think about culture jamming more along those lines, through forms of collective action, uprisings, whether they're in cities, parks, or elsewhere.
I'm speaking with Springfield-based author Richard Gilman Apowski. He also teaches in the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois at Springfield. And Richard, would you say then that do you think Black Lives Matter is a similar movement?
Black Lives Matter, I think, is different than Occupy Wall Street. Black Lives Matter seems to me to be taking up unfinished business in this country's history of brutal racism. And I think that Black Lives Matter really emerged out of revolts within specific cities that were expressing their outrage, their disaffection with a long line of police killings of unarmed Black youth. So we saw this in Ferguson in 2014 with the case of Michael Brown, and then in Baltimore in 2015 after Freddie Gray, and then in Charlotte most recently in 2016. And all of these moments, these uprisings were moments in the development of what we now call and have been calling for a while Black Lives Matter. And I think what Black Lives Matter is really an outgrowth of, it's an outgrowth of a long history of Black revolt in the U.S. It's not something that started in Ferguson for example, it's not something that started recently. It's something that picks up where Watts, Los Angeles, in 1965 left off, where Rodney King in Los Angeles in 1992 left off, where the Springfield race riot in 1908 left off, and before that, a long history of slave revolts and rebellions. This country has an unfinished history of having to address its racist past and present. And I think that Black Lives Matter is far more intimately connected with that history of racism, than the history of inequality. Of course, though, these things are connected. They are connected, and we have to also try to see how Black Lives Matter is picking up the unfinished business of Occupy Wall Street. But I look at these moments as nodal points in a larger fabric of revolt.
I see. So you wouldn't necessarily think it's because that's an interesting thing, because when I think about sort of maybe more a layman's perspective of protest or revolt, and I think about the Black Lives Matter movement, I think about words that we heard from the civil rights movement, which is that I'm thinking in particular of Dr. King, you know, it sort of seems as if when you're thinking about a protest or a revolution, it is from people who are mobilizing to demand change from systems of power or authority. Is that a wrong way to look at it?
No, I think it's very beautifully said. It's more well said than my own words. It's wonderful. Yeah, I think that a revolt is not something that people in power need. A revolt is, when I said before that a revolt is something that either breaks the law or directly runs up against the limits of the law and presses those limits, that's not something that people in power need, because they were able to acquire their positions of power, whether we're talking about race or class or gender, or any other issue, political power, within the limits of the law. So for them, revolt is something they don't need. And so it's much easier for them to vilify revolt, to call it irrational, to call it violent, because they don't need revolt. They don't need revolt to help them speak.
I remember.
So
okay.
Yeah.
And this is the phrase, and I looked it up, and one of the producers was very helpful here. Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, I think that's a great quote. And I think Martin Luther King Jr. is actually one of the figures who could help us link Black Lives Matter to Occupy Wall Street, because Martin Luther King Jr., this is not how King is celebrated in my son's school, my son's elementary school, or in the national holiday.
No, everyone thinks of the I Have a Dream, Dr. King, right? That's
the
62-63 Dr. King. No one's thinking about 67-68.
No one's thinking about 67-68, but King was very unsparingly critical of capitalism and inequality. King himself condemned American capitalism as directly related to the condition of Black people in the country. And he also said something which I quote in my book about riots and revolts. And if I could just read you that briefly.
Sure.
King, in 1968, in a speech called The Other America, said, "It is not enough for me to stand before you tonight and condemn riots. It would be morally irresponsible for me to do that without at the same time condemning the intolerable conditions that exist in our society. And I must say tonight that a riot is the language of the unheard." And for me, that last line, that riot is a way that people who don't have power, who are unheard, speak. A riot, a revolt, an uprising, the types of thing we've seen in Ferguson and Baltimore and Charlotte, that this is the language of the unheard, is really the launching off point for my whole book. And it's a way that we can also see connections between income inequality and poverty and race. Because, like, if you look at Baltimore, for example, It's a predominantly black city, but it's also one of the poorest cities in America in one of the richest states, located in one of the richest states. So we do have to draw these lines, but we also need to look at riot and revolt as a way of speaking, a way of thinking, a language of the unheard, because what we still see a lot of is the same condemnation that King condemned in 1968. So when these things happen in our cities, often in the mainstream media, you hear condemnations of their irrationality, of their violence. Isn't there some other way that they could say what they have to say? No, those other ways have been tried, often for decades. And so what we have to do is we have to learn how to read, to hear, to listen to other languages than the ones we're accustomed to.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Springfield-based political scientist Richard Gilman Opalski. His new book is called Specters of the Revolt. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by...
I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. My guest is Springfield-based author Richard Gilman Opalski. He is the author of a new book. It's called Specters of Revolt. He teaches political philosophy. He's a chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Springfield. Richard, you know, when you mention revolution and you mention revolution as an agent for change, I do think, and you write about this, we don't think of revolutions, I think, in a positive sense. Most people don't. I imagine if you're, maybe it depends ideologically, clearly, I think, like, you know, if you're an anarchist or maybe you think of revolution a little bit more positively than sort of, I would guess, is the sort of normal American ideology doesn't look positively on current revolutions anyway. Let's put it that way, right? Because we all love the American Revolution,
right.
But we don't like even the notion of a revolution now. And I wonder, why is that fear? And how much does the actual fear of that affect the actual possibility of revolt? We started this whole conversation talking about this current moment that we're in right now in this country. How much is the fear of revolt? How much does that motivate what we do, what politicians do, the way we react as a society to different protests?
Well, it's such an important question. I mean, I think that the United States doesn't really have much of an imagination or a positive idea of revolution. And even when you say that, of course, we love the American Revolution, I don't even think that's true, because I think that, you know, when we should be celebrating the American Revolution, for example, July 4th, oftentimes, that's not a revolutionary holiday. It's oftentimes more of a chauvinistic, patriotic holiday, where people are thinking more about their support for the current regime or the current war than they are about this country's revolutionary past. So there really isn't much in the U.S. by way of an enduring interest in, you know, the good things that can come from revolution, not even from our own. So I think that what has to happen, if we're talking about the U.S., and of course, you know, my book is not really focused on the U.S. alone, but if we were thinking about the U.S., what really has to happen is we've got to see the terrible limitations of the non-revolutionary options. So when you look, for example, at Trump and the recent election, I mean, it is fairly easy to criticize Trump. I think it's easier to criticize Trump, especially for people on the left, than it would have been to criticize Clinton. There's no question about that. In fact, I would be surprised if the same rallies and protests occurred in the wake of a Clinton victory. So, but at the same time, Clinton was, she had much of the Bush war cabinet behind her. She was openly embraced by Henry Kissinger, whose foreign policy we have many decades of atrocious experience, horrible experience, and other people elsewhere, a more catastrophic experience of on the receiving end. Clinton was also one of the big proponents of the free trade neoliberalism that her husband inaugurated in 1994 with NAFTA. And I think that a lot of the left and a lot of even liberals really had a shortage of enthusiasm for a Clinton administration. We wouldn't have been in the streets had she won, and the differences between Trump and Clinton, we cannot make this a small thing, are very big and very significant. And we have seen that since Trump took the oath of office. But I think that we have to reach a point at some point where we realize the terrible limitations and deficits that are available through conventional politics. If we do that, then in the U.S. we might see the emergence of more interest in the possibilities we can get through revolts and possibly some form of revolutionary activity, which I don't think would look like what people imagined in the 19th century, but nonetheless something else, something other than the conventional channels of procedural electoral politics. If we don't become sufficiently dissatisfied with the two main parties in this country, I think we can expect an indefinite continuation of the same faith in the same roads of electoral politics. My own view is that neither of those roads ever lead us to where we need to go on questions like equality, opportunity, racism, sexism, and they have not done so. But if we don't reach a point where we're really disaffected with the options on offer, the same negative attitude, the same dismissive attitude of any more radical or revolutionary politics will continue.
Richard, do you think, though, as I'm thinking about not just the United States, I'm thinking about you're saying sort of this dissatisfaction with the current political system, with the status quo. Certainly, we're seeing this happen across the world. You know, we have the Brexit vote. We're seeing rising populist movements across Europe, kind of loosely, whether you identify that as I don't even know if the labels far right and far left make a difference anymore, if it's more globalization sort of seems to be kind of a term that makes a lot more sense in terms of what people are organizing around, whether they're for or against that. And I wonder, do you think that sort of, does that signal to you, I don't know if revolt is the right word, but does that signal to you sort of a change in the way that we are organizing ourselves along political lines across the world?
Well, I'm not entirely sure. I think that part of my job, as I see it, is to watch and see what happens and to learn from it as an observer who isn't unwilling to think in different directions. Now, what we're seeing globally is, as you point out rightly, I think, a kind of somewhat surprising resurgence of old right-wing populisms, even openly white supremacist and nationalist ideologies. And
right, well, certainly we're seeing that, right? For example, yeah. In the Netherlands, that's a very clear discussion, right?
In the Netherlands, in France, in Germany, and elsewhere, we're seeing real challenges to the kind of liberal cosmopolitan idea. And Brexit is one a rejection of the cosmopolitan hope of the European Union in the UK, but also just the burden that Germany has had to take in dealing with the economic crisis since 2008 has seen, even that in that country, real disaffection with the cosmopolitan idea. People saying, hey, maybe we should be Germans first and Europeans second, third, or fourth, because why should we have to rescue the economy of Greece and things like that?
And accept refugees that are coming from other parts of the world as well. Right.
Mm-hmm. That is a huge piece of it, right? There are nationalist reactions against immigration, refugees. The refugee crisis has really mobilized a new xenophobic rage in European countries as well as in the U.S. So I think that in some ways things haven't so much changed as we're seeing an old idea come back, maybe an old idea come back that we had hoped would not.
So to your mind, you are seeing this, do you sort of see from a historical perspective this sort of a mirroring of the 1930s?
Well, I don't know about that. I think one of the other surprising comebacks, we've seen a somewhat surprising comeback of some of these right-wing populisms, nationalisms, extreme forms of xenophobia and all the rest. But we have also seen a somewhat surprising comeback of Marxism and of communist and socialist ideas. Another thing that after many decades of Cold War, if you talk about from the 1930s on up to 1989, 1991, it would have really surprised anybody in the 90s or the early 2000s that ideas from Marx would be also making a comeback in 2017. But they have, and they have since 2008 all around the world. So we're seeing the return of some really dangerous nationalist ideas, but we're also seeing the return of some of the old liberatory and internationalist ideas to counter them. I don't know yet what will come of all of this, but I can tell you as a political scientist who saw the villain of the communist replaced with the villain of the terrorist, that it was a total shock to see that there was still a popular resonance for the ideas of Marx, not just in Europe where you might, or in Latin America where that might be less surprising, but even here in the U.S. Bernie Sanders, for example, was somebody who was able to speak about the catastrophes of capitalism and the virtues of socialism. That's a remarkable surprise.
I wonder, when we think about that, you've also said, and I want to just get back to, we just have a couple more minutes left, but I want to get back to this notion that you brought up at the beginning of our conversation about the idea of ghosts or hauntings, and how that there's just certain things that kind of tend to kind of seep into the way that we look at all of these things. And I wonder, what are you trying to convey about revolutions by using this idea of ghosts or hauntings?
That's another very important big question for me, and I think the issue from my perspective would be that all the old revolutionary hopes were dashed in the 20th century. They were dashed. They were lost. And there were people who thought that there was going to be a great revolution and a total transformation and a socialist utopia here or there, not just after the First World War, but even after the Second, and not just after the Second World War, but in the anti-colonial project, and that the Algerian Liberation Front was going to lead to another great victory. And none of these things resolved themselves in those ways. So there was a real loss of hope in all those old revolutionary ideas. And I can understand why. And I understand why those revolutionary hopes were dashed from a historical point of view. And politically, I see that the loss of faith in revolution makes total sense. All the great revolutionary projects and aspirations never came to fruition, not even close. And even the best efforts were also at the same time failures. And we have to account for that and accept it and reckon with it with honesty. But what also is true is that the old problems that the revolution sought to solve have not been solved. They have not been solved either, and they're still with us. Today, we are still talking about inequality, inequality that is worse now than it was in Marx's life and times in 1848. We are still talking about the brutal exclusions of racism and poverty, but we're also still talking about expulsions as we see in refugee crises. And what is clear is that on the one hand, we have given up on revolution, and so have the revolutionaries. But we also need to hold on to that revolutionary hope that we could solve these very basic problems. The problems we've been talking about in this interview are not new problems. They're old problems, and they haven't gotten better. And so what I think that revolt is, it's not a revolutionary promise. It's not a revolution, and it's not a revolutionary promise. But it's empirical evidence in real events in the real world that people demand more than they're getting within the limits of the existing system and situation. And that gives me hope. It gives me hope. It gave the people in Tahrir Square hope. It gives new generations of young people who for the first time stand up together and demand opportunities and equality. It gives them hope, and it changes their lives. Young people participating in Occupy Wall Street are politicized. They're never the same. Young people who participate in the Arab Spring are changed by that experience, and they start to demand things that were what were previously thought impossible. And I think that that is important. I think it's very important for people to insist upon more than what is readily available. And it's very important for new generations of young people to imagine other worlds than the world we have. And I believe that revolt, where we see it happening, while it isn't a revolution, and nothing really does promise the things that revolutions of the 19th century hoped for. Nothing does. But the eternal recurrence of revolt, the fact that every society knows that the possibility of revolt is somewhere on the horizon, gives me hope, because it shows us that people who've become accustomed to accepting the unacceptable, to tolerating the intolerable, have their limits, and sometimes stand up and demand something else. And I think that's what we need to do.
Thanks so much for joining us to talk about your new book, Specters of Revolt. Richard Gilman Opalski is the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Illinois. Richard, thanks. Thanks for talking to us about this moment.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Revelation.
That's One by musician Aaron Nigel Smith. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Aaron's in town for a concert tomorrow in Urbana. He's received a Parents' Choice Award in 2008. He joined the cast of PBS Kids show Between the Lions. His latest album is actually called One. It's off the label Aya Productions. He's in studio with me in our performance studio. Hey, Aaron, welcome to The 21st.
Greetings.
Welcome to Illinois.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I should mention to everybody, the free concert he's performing is Saturday morning at the Cranert Center for Performing Arts in Urbana. Aaron, your work is dedicated to kids and the arts. Why did you decide to focus your music specifically for children?
You know, I had a major shift in my career. I was singing classical music, touring all around the world with a group called the Albert McNeil Jubilee Singers, and I had my first child, Zion, and the rigors of kind of being on the road and whatnot were kind of, you know, making home life a little challenging at times, so I decided to take a risk and stop touring and jump into the classroom and teach youth. And once from the first class I had, I was just really, really profoundly impacted by it and really wanted to shift my focus to educating. I really found my calling, you know, through working with youth in an educational format, educational and entertaining and kind of mixing it all up together, you know. So it was really actually a surprise, you know.
So was it different for you to shift when you started thinking about your work as a musician and focusing on children? How did you shift your work in terms of the music that you were performing? Did you have to think about things differently?
I really did, you know, because singing classical is very technical and it's more about, you know, the end result and the performance. And so I kind of went more inward and worked on the process, you know, and really wanted to draw out creativity from children, because creativity for me was really a tool to really change my life and set me on a different trajectory. And so I feel that desire now to just plant these little seeds of, you know, music into the youth around the world. And so I definitely think more of it about the process rather than the end result these days. And then I've had the really great fortune of being, you know, motivated to write songs for children, so I can kind of contemplate the ideas that I want to share with them or teach them or encourage them through. And using music as a tool for learning has been really, really wonderful for me.
And so 15 years ago, you founded a music arts education program. It's in more than 100 early education centers across the country, from San Francisco to Boston. Can you tell me about that? What's sort of the idea behind that?
Yeah, that was really the fundamentals of music and movement was the impetus for me to really launch my educational and children's music performing career. And so, yeah, it was really cool. I used to bounce around from preschool to preschool and just, you know, teach children about music and infuse with yoga and creative movement. And it really took off in Los Angeles, to where we had all those local preschools, and I partnered with all the studio daycare centers, Fox and Paramount and Warner Brothers and Sony. I was the music guy for all of those daycare centers. And beyond that, I ultimately, you know, got a little creative space and hired a bunch of teachers and franchised it. And actually, it's out of my hands now. I actually ended up selling it to one of the top licensees who's out of D.C. now, and she's kind of taken it and run with it. So it's really, really a cool – that's one thing I'm really most proud of is Fundamentals, because it's provided actually careers for other people, young musicians, and then hundreds and thousands of children now have learned my methodology. So it's
yeah.
pretty cool.
So we've been talking about your methodology. Let's hear some of your music. What do you want to play for us?
I would like to play a song off my new album, One, and it's called Loving and Kind.
Great.
Yeah.
Loving and kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be. Loving and kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be. Back in elementary school, my bike was stolen, it was so uncool. Now what was I to do? Wish everybody used the golden rule. My teacher noticed I was so unhappy and did her best to comfort me. The next day she quietly brought a bike from home and gave it to me. Loving and kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be. I know two brothers always fussing with one another. Now what if they discover that they could be best friends with each other? They'd sing in harmony and work together like the perfect team. No more hurt feelings. Now wouldn't that be so much better than fighting? Loving in kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be. Loving in kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be. I can't forget some of our heroes who lived a life to share and love. Martin Luther King, Gandhi, Mother Teresa and Mandela. And everyday people like you and me can start to live up and do good things for our community. Let's be kind to our neighbors and family. Loving and kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be. Loving and kind is what I'm trying to teach all the children to be. And I hope they'll find in time just why that's the only way we should be.
That's Loving in Kind. It's Aaron Nigel Smith. He's a children's reggae artist. That's off of his latest album, One. He's in town. He's got a performance this weekend. And Aaron, there's such a great story in there about your bike being stolen when you were a kid. It's like a sad story. But, I mean, it's really awful. I mean, do you find that are you kind of going back to your childhood a lot for these songs, to these stories of things that happened to you, to kind of share those lessons with kids?
Absolutely. Music has really changed and had a profound impact on my life. And so telling stories through the music and giving insights into my past through the music has been a helpful tool, actually, for communication and for healing,
What do you think, as I, a lot of people don't know this about me. I actually taught preschool for a while. It was like my summer job when I was a journalist, and
nice.
Then I taught for a year. I love that age because I feel like we can learn a lot from them. And as someone who you work with a lot of that age preschoolers, what do you think adults can learn from how children react to music?
Yeah, I think they can learn honesty, and compassion. I mean, children are going to let you know how they're feeling in the moment and be really pretty honest about it. And if your message isn't resonating with them, if your vibe isn't resonating with them, then they'll let you know. So I use children.
Yeah, you can't be fake around kids, right?
You really can't. When you step into the classroom or performance space, the children know if you want to be there or not. And so I think children help to keep me honest, and I'm really mindful of my intention when I step in front of the youth. Am I really here to serve them? Am I here for my purposes, or am I here for the community? So I think I can learn a lot. I have learned a lot from the youth that I've had the opportunity to work with.
Do you want to play another song for us?
I'd love to, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think I'll play... this is from one of my first albums, Everyone Loves to Dance, and it's the title track off of that album, So... I think I'll do that one. I'm kind of looking for my guitar pick right now because it's more of a guitar picky song.
Okay.
So I'm going to sneak into my back pocket and grab it. And this song, you'll listen and hear. And if you're at home right now and you feel like getting up off your seat, and rocking out to the beat, this would be a good time for that. There's some instructions in it, and don't be shy to follow along with it, even if you're at home, all right?
Up to you. side to side, come on, and rock it side to side, that's right, rock it side to side, huh. Cause you know Aaron Nigel makes you feel alright, let's dance, yeah, 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 well, everyone loves to move, yeah, 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 it's all up to you, yeah, 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 as long as you've got the groove, yeah, 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 hey, let me see you bounce, up and down, come on, let's bounce, up and down, that's right, bounce, up and down, come on, cause you know Aaron Nigel will rock you out, let's dance, yeah, 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 well, everyone loves to move, yeah, 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 it's all up to you, yeah, 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 as long as you've got the groove, yeah, 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 everybody get up on your feet and dance to the beat. No need to be afraid, you just move your body. Get up on your feet and dance to the beat. You've got the groove for your whole family. Let's dance, yeah, yeah, yeah. Everyone loves to move, yeah, yeah. It's all up to you, yeah, yeah. As long as you've got the groove, yeah, yeah. Cause everyone loves to dance. All right.
So that's Aaron Nigel Smith. He is performing. His latest album is One off the label's Aya Productions. He's in Urbana. Tomorrow, there's a free concert Saturday morning at the Cranart Center for Performing Arts. Doors open at 10. I'm sorry. The concert's at 10. The doors open at 9 for crafts and other activities. That was some of the acoustic version. We're going to go out and end the show today on one of the tracks from his album. It's called Dance to the Reggae Rhythm. Aaron, thanks so much for being with me.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me. Peace and love.
Yeah! You know this is Father Goose. Alongside Aaron Nigel Smith in the mix. Oh, you catch a copy of this.
That does it for us today. You can always find all the information about us at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
Won't you try? Dance to the reggae rhythm, children. Feel your heartbeat. There's really nothing to it. You just move your feet. Take time in life. Enjoy each other. Music's awesome.